Station, Green Acres Garden Center and Florist in Coffeyville, helping your home show off.
And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. Hope your day is going fantastically. Currently outside, it is 67 degrees, so we're slightly warming up. And for today, we're looking at a high of around 84 degrees, so going to be fairly warm out there today. I don't think we have much of a shot of rain at all today until basically the overnight hours, and then we have a chance of severe weather tomorrow morning, so we're going to be on the lookout for that if things do get severe. Keep it locked here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. We'll keep you advised of what is going on. But it is now time for Greenside up here this morning on the Mighty 690 KGGF, and welcoming to the studio, of course, is Jesse Gilmore. Everybody knows Jesse, and we have a new person in today. We have Holly Miner, and guys, welcome this morning. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Thanks for asking.
Good, thank you.
All right. Well, before we get started, Jesse, you were telling me about one program that you have coming up, the Garden State, the K-State Garden Hour, correct?
Yep. So our June webinar is coming up for K-State Garden Hour. It's going to be on Wednesday from noon to 1 via Zoom. This specific class will be on effective irrigation for your garden plants, being down here in southeastern Kansas. Not a ton of irrigation is needed right now. If you've, you know, been outside recently, you know that the water's kind of piling up. But when we get into the hotter months, it's important to know how much to water and the most effective methods of getting water to your garden plants, whether they're vegetables or ornamentals. So this webinar is going to cover a lot of topics relating to watering and some good techniques for kind of minimizing the labor that goes into watering your garden plants.
Yeah, because unfortunately the water will, the rain will turn off at some point once we get into the summer months, and then we'll be crying for rain.
Yep, all right. A period of extremes.
Yes, it is. But again, no chance of rain today until the overnight hours. And I want to welcome into studio for the first time Holly Miner. And Holly, good morning. Thank you for coming on today.
Good morning.
Well, you know, Jesse just gave a program that's coming up, and you have a workshop you'd like to talk about fairly quickly, correct?
Yes, I do. So I'm the nutrition, food safety, and health agent. So a lot of the things that I do relate to food and food preservation and food safety. And so today I'd like to share information about some pressure canner testing dates that we have coming up. Every year it's important, if you have a dial gauge pressure canner, to have it tested. And so some of the dates that we have coming up for that testing in Independence on June 1st. Just bring your pressure canner in and I'll check it out. It takes about 15 minutes to do that, and it's a free service that we offer through the Extension office. So June 1st in Independence. June 3rd will be in Pittsburgh at the office in Pittsburgh. On June 4th, I'll be in Girard. And on June 8th in Altamont, and June 9th in Fredonia.
All right, so some good workshops coming up, so be sure to check those out. And again, if you missed any of those dates, we'll give those again here in just a few minutes, and you'll also be able to check them online once we put the show up on our website at kggfradio.com. So what are the few things you would like to talk about today, Holly?
Well, I also do food preservation classes, and so I have a couple classes coming up. June 17th, I'll be doing a class on jams and jellies, and on June 24th, I'll be doing a class on pressure canning and dehydrating. So anybody that's interested in those classes can give us a call at our office in Independence. And this is off the top of my head, so I hope I'm doing this right.
You're
it's
fine.
620-331-2690, I believe, is the correct number. I always get the last four confused, so I apologize if I don't have it right and I don't have a business card in front of me. So I've been here about a month and a half, so you have to forgive me. If I don't know the number yet.
Well, just confirmed that is correct.
Okay, good.
and even then, they can get a hold of any of the K-State Extension offices, and they'll be able to direct you. They'll be able to direct them to you, correct?
Correct.
So,
correct.
Just yes. In case, if you maybe not know one, but you know another, they obviously can connect you to those offices. So,
right.
So got some good preservation and canning, pressure canning workshops coming up. So for somebody that I grew up in the city, so I wasn't around canning very much. So just what is pressure canning?
So there's two kinds of canning methods. There's pressure canning and there's water bath canning. And the method that you use is really determined by the acidity of the food that you are preserving. So low acid foods such as potatoes, carrots, corn, most of your vegetables, all meats, and a few fruits, but mostly meats and vegetables need to be pressure canned because they are a low acid food. They don't have a lot of acid in them. Pressure canning creates steam in the canner, and that steam can reach 240 degrees or more. And we want to make sure that our food is pressure canned when it's low acid, because that will help kill the Clostridium botulinum bacteria or the botulism bacteria. So botulism creates a spore, a heat protective spore. And if you water bath can low acid foods, that heat protective spore prevents it, that covering prevents the bacteria from being killed. So botulism can then grow. Botulism is a bacteria that does not require air. So in a closed canning jar is the perfect environment for it to grow. It's really important that we do kill that with those temperatures up to 240 degrees. And, you know, there's been a lot of concerns from people about, I don't want to do that because I'm scared my pressure canner is going to blow up and I'm going to have a big accident in my house. And so, you know, come to a class. We'd love to work with you and help alleviate those fears. It is a safe process when done correctly, and we just want to make sure that people are using proper methods to preserve their foods. One of the other things that we really focus on is making sure that we're using tested recipes, or recipes that have been proven to be safe for our use. And so you might get a lot of people have grandma's pickle recipe, and they loved grandma's pickles because they just turned out wonderfully. Well, we need to make sure that that is a tested, USDA-tested recipe, that the amount of vinegar, which is the acid in that case, is the correct amount that will allow the food to be preserved in a water bath canner without having to worry about pressure canning it. You know, if you pressure canned pickles, they're going to be very soft and soggy and pretty much disintegrate. But so that's why we add the acid to them to help with the pickling process and to keep them crisp, because everybody loves a nice crisp pickle.
Exactly.
And so we just want to make sure that the amount of acid that's used in the pickle recipe is enough that's not going to allow the botulism to be able to form.
And we hear about that sometimes, people getting botulism, and it could be pretty serious, can it not?
It can be deadly, yes. We recently watched a video of a lady in the West, I believe Utah or somewhere, I'm not exactly sure, but she had decided that she was going to pressure can some green beans, and she went through the whole process. She, however, did not do the process correctly. She had never pressure canned before. She didn't know how to use her canner. She didn't know about the vent cover. She didn't use the vent cover, so she never built up any pressure in her canner. She put too much water in the canner, which did not allow enough steam to be created to get the pressure high enough, or the heat to be able to raise high enough to get to 240 degrees, and didn't process them for the correct amount of time to be able to kill the bacteria. So, you know, you have food in a jar, the inside part of that jar has to reach that 240 degrees for a certain amount of time in order for that to kill the bacteria. And when you don't follow a recipe that is correct, or you're not following correct processing times or correct pressures, that will definitely have an effect on how safe your food is.
Now, does it to get it up to 240 degrees, is each food the same amount of time to do that, or is it kind of range depending on what kind of food it is?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because it does depend on the type of food and how the food is prepared. If it's cut into smaller pieces, then it's going to take a little bit smaller amount of time. But you really need to follow a tested recipe. So you can't guess on things like this, and you don't want to, because your health and your life and the health of your family is more important. You know, a small little jar of food that you might can at home, is that really worth a $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 or even more $1,000 hospital stay? You know, it's really not. So use the correct method. Make sure that you're using tested recipes, following USDA guidelines when you're preserving food, and then you should come up with a product that is safe to eat.
And if you're not 100% sure, one, either don't do it, or if you think you've done it wrong, it's just safe, best to just kind of throw it out. That way you don't get sick or even worse.
Right. We do have a saying, when in doubt, throw it out. Right. So that is our saying. And you know, this can be used for foods that are canned commercially as well. If you have a can of food in your cabinet that is bulging, that is leaking, has dents in it, you know, a lot of times stores will sell food that is dented as a discount. I would never recommend someone to purchase a food that has been in a jar or can that has been dented. You don't know if the seam has been compromised or the seal has been compromised on that food. And those kinds of things should be thrown away. I can remember when I was a little girl, my mom had a can of beans that were bulging, and so she took them back to the grocery store and they gave her a different can of beans that were not bulging. But that particular can of beans had something wrong with it, and my mom was savvy enough to be able to recognize that and know that that was not the way that a can of beans should look, and was not safe to be eaten.
And hopefully the store threw that particular can out or sent it back to the distributor to let right. them know, hey, this is what's going on here, because they got to recoup their costs as well. So yeah. Some great information there. We do have somebody on the phone real quick, and we'll see what they would like to talk about real quick. And caller, you're on Green Side Up. Good morning. How are you doing today? Are you? Hold on. Let's try that again.
Yeah, the top of it got burnt by that cold, and I cut off all the dead on it, and it looked like appeared there was some green at the bottom. Is that the right thing to do?
Can you do that again? Can you say that again, caller? I didn't have you on at the very start, so can you just repeat that real quick?
My azalea, the top of it got burnt by the cold. Okay, the bottom was still looked like it had some new green shoots coming out, so I cut off all the dead. Was that the right thing to do?
Okay, so I have gotten questions about evergreens a lot recently because of the freezes. Azaleas are typically going to be evergreen. They're going to keep most of their leaves. However, evergreens suffer from winter desiccation. You see this most of the time on hollies, but on a lot of other evergreen shrubs, it causes the same issue. What likely happened is that the branches were not dead. One thing that you can do to test the life or death of a particular branch is test the flexibility towards the end. If the twigs at the end of certain branches are still bending, that means they're still getting water and resources, and that the leaves are the problem. If they snap when they're supposed to bend, then the water and resources have dried up to them. What likely happened with your azalea is that the winter winds allowed for constant evaporation of water out of the leaves during the hard freezes. And without, occasional precipitation events, like rain, sometimes snow will help replace some of that water if it melts, but for a while there, we didn't have any snow melting. The leaves can dry up because of constant water evaporation out of what's known as the stomata, or the pores on the bottom of the leaf. So what you would see if this was the case is you would see just a very quick leaf drop for the most part. Sometimes, and on azaleas, I've seen this quite often, they'll keep the lowest leaves, but drop everything else. Usually that's just going to be a leaf problem and not a problem with the rest of the shrub. And it should leaf out in future growing seasons. It won't typically harm the long-term health of the plant if it loses its leaves once or twice. However, it is something to try and curb in future years so that the resource stress doesn't pile on year after year when they have to replace leaves multiple times. But you likely did not do any damage trimming back some of the azaleas. You just want to make sure that you don't trim off more than a third of the live growth in any given year, and especially because of the winter that we had. You do want to make sure that in periods of extreme dryness, like I'm expecting we're going to get here in about 3 weeks or so, you want to make sure that you occasionally give it water so that it's not overstressed on multiple fronts, trying to push out new growth in the leaves and also keep itself hydrated.
Okay, well, the stuff I cut off, I cut it down to where the limbs started showing some life.
Mm-hmm.
The part I cut off at the top, it was dead.
Okay.
It was completely dead.
Yeah, if it is dead, then you did nothing wrong there. Dead tissue that you prune out of a shrub or tree will not count towards that rule of thirds for cutting out, you know, live growth during a year because it's not alive, so it's not going to cause any resource stress on the azalea.
I didn't want to cut off more than I had to. I knew that I just wanted to trim off the very top of it. So, okay, well, thank you.
Yep.
All right, thank you very much, caller. We appreciate it. And Holly, if anybody has any more questions, though, about food preservation and also pressure canning, how can they get a hold of you once again?
So I'm in the Independence office in Kansas here in the Wildcat District, and they can get a hold of me at that office, or you can call any of the offices in Pittsburgh, Altamont, Fredonia, or Girard, and they can get a hold of me as well. Or if you would like to email, my email address is haminer, M-I-N-E-R, at ksu.edu. And so that's another way to get a hold of me. Or that phone number again is 620-331-2690.
Well, Holly, thank you so much for coming in today. We really do appreciate it. And hopefully we'll get to see you a little bit more.
All right, thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we will have news at the top of the hour. And welcome back to Greenside Up here on the Mighty 690 KGGF here on your hump day morning here in Southeast Kansas. Kyle High with you this morning. And joining me in studio, once again, Jesse Gilmore and Holly Miner. And Jesse, before we get to your subject for today, again, you have a workshop coming up, correct?
Yep, it is a webinar series put on by the Horticulture and Natural Resources Program on campus, hosted by a different extension agent for horticulture across the state. So you get to see a lot of different faces for gardening, and you get to basically tap the collective knowledge of every horticulture agent in the chat if you, you know, have questions about that particular topic. This week's, not today's, but a week from today, the topic will be on irrigation for your garden plants, whether they be vegetables or ornamentals. It will be very important when the rains dry up, like they apparently do every year, knowing exactly how much water and how to kind of minimize the effort needed to water your garden plants and keep them looking healthy throughout kind of leaner times when we don't get as much rain as we need.
All right. And Holly, we'll come back to you here for 1 second as well, because you do have a workshop coming up as well, correct?
Yes, the pressure canner testing workshops. Again, those locations are the first in Independence, the third in Pittsburgh, the fourth Girard, the eighth Altamont, and the ninth in Fredonia.
All right, so some good workshops coming up. Again, you will be able to hear those dates again on this program, which will be put onto our website, kggfradio.com. All right, Jesse, well, getting you started today, one of the things you want to talk about is hardiness zones. So what is a hardiness zone?
So a hardiness zone is essentially the cold that a plant can survive and still come back the following year. These are put out by the USDA, and the common graphic that you'll see for the hardiness zones is a color map of the different zones. And this map represents the average minimum temperature in this particular geographic area every year. So, for example, in our area, like in Pittsburgh, Kansas, where I live, we're in zone 6B, which means that the average minimum temperature will be somewhere between 5 below and 0 degrees. For a lot of the listening area, especially down in kind of the Oklahoma area, you're going to be in zone 7A, which means that your average minimum temperature is going to be between 0 and 5 degrees, meaning that if you don't have a plant that is rated to zone 6B or 7A, the cold will likely kill it off. And this is important for plants, especially that are grown farther south. They're what's known as cold tender plants, where frosts or freezes, especially if we have freezes like this past year, or this past February, they will die off. And we've been seeing that a lot with mimosa trees. Mimosa trees are a zone 6 to 10 garden plant. So theoretically, they would be able to survive in our area, but again, we're seeing a lot of them die down to the ground, and that's because hardiness zones are an average. They don't represent the minimum temperature every year. They can be lower than that. They can be higher than that. Most of the time, they'll be higher than that, but if you get a severe enough freeze, your minimum temperature is going to be lower than that plant is rated for, and it could die off. And that's why it's important to kind of shoot down the middle when going for hardiness zones. That way you have a little bit of wiggle room in its in that particular plant's adaptability.
All right. If you can do me just one favor real quick, twist that mic where it's facing you, because it sounds just a little bit hollow. So, okay. So we'll keep it going here. So do hardiness zones apply to all plants?
No, they do not. Hardiness zones only apply to plants that will come back in future growing seasons. That's going to be herbaceous perennials or woody plants like shrubs or trees. Annuals, by their nature, have a life cycle where they die off in the winter anyway. So they come up in the spring, they put out as much seed as they can to reproduce, and then they die off. So there's no real need to rate annuals for their cold tolerance since they're going to die off anyway. Biennials are a little bit different. They will die back to the ground 1 year, and then they'll come up again and basically seed out in their second year. Cold tolerance does matter a little more for those, but not quite as much, since they are still going to basically die out in 2 years. Shrubs and trees, that's where the cold tolerance really comes into play, because those are the purpose of putting those in your landscape is that they're going to be there as long as possible. And so you want to make sure that your cold tolerance is such that they will have the best chance of surviving. And you can't really do that if you're trying to grow, what's a good example? Like passion fruit. There are species of passion fruit or passion flower that are hardy to our zone. They're called maypops. They are a different species technically than the passion fruit that is sold as a fruit. The maypop is going to be much less commercially desirable for their fruit, but as a kind of a trade-off, they will have a much better chance of surviving our cold conditions. They're more adapted to a northern environment than the passion fruit is. So you'll see those in a lot of cases where some species in a particular genus will be adapted to more northern environments, while some will be adapted to more southern environments. You always want to shoot for more cold tolerant plants if possible, but there can be ways to keep more cold-sensitive plants alive, and I think we'll cover that here in a second.
And you're talking about hardiness zones apply to cold tolerance. Is there something similar for heat?
Yes, there is. The American Horticulture Society has put out a heat zone map, kind of similar to the USDA's cold hardiness map. This is going to specifically be for the number of days with an average temperature above 86 degrees during the year. A lot of the listening area is going to fall into zone 7, which has somewhere between 60 and 90 days of of heat above 86 degrees. Most of the Oklahoma listening area will be in zone 8, which has somewhere between 90 and 120 days of heat above 86 degrees. This is a much newer system of measurement than the hardiness zone map with the USDA is. So there's a little bit more tinkering that is being done with this map. The USDA hardiness map, I believe it was last changed in 2015, which bumped southeastern Kansas up to 6B, whereas before it was just a straight 6. The AHS heat map, I believe, I want to say it was created in 2006. Don't quote me on that, though. But it has not been in use nearly as long, and so you are not really going to find information on plant labels for heat tolerance like you will for cold tolerance yet. But that information is getting out there.
And how common is this information?
I would say that anywhere you go where you buy plants, you will find at least the information for cold tolerance. If you're buying from a local store, especially like local garden centers, they will almost always carry plants that only do that only have the cold tolerance for our area. There might be some borderline plants like mimosa trees, which are, you know, in the range of where they can grow here, but are kind of bordering that edge. That is definitely something to consider before putting a plant in your environment. But any garden center you go to is going to have that cold hardiness information. In my experience, I have not seen plants with heat tolerance, like the heat zone ranges on their label yet. Hopefully that is something that we start to see more of, because region of extremes, you're going to get a lot of, you're going to get some cold, but you're also going to get a lot of heat without a lot of rain. So you kind of run the gambit, and it needs a balance of both.
Yeah, so can plants grow outside of their hardiness zones?
Yes, but it's going to take a lot of help from you. And there's really three ways that you can keep a cold sensitive plant alive during a particularly harsh winter. The first is to design with microclimates in mind. A microclimate describes the kind of the atmosphere immediately above the ground. It's, you know, when we think of climate, we think of weather patterns and temperature and stuff like that. This is on a very small area scale. Up to about 100 feet above the atmosphere. And microclimate can be used to basically provide extra heat that these plants are going to need to get through the winter. The number one thing you can do to keep sensitive plants warmer is place it on the south side of your house. In the winter, the sun gets lower in the sky as the earth tilts away from the sun. So it will have more southerly exposure, and the south wall of your house, if you can plant on the south side of your house, will reflect any light and heat back towards the plants that are right in front of it, especially if there's windows. So that will increase the heat of the air directly around the plant. If you can plant on the west side of your house too, like especially if it's like the southwest corner or a southwest facing wall, you're going to get the most intense light from afternoon and evening sun, which is on the west side of your house. So the south and the west, primarily more the south than the west, though. There are some people who have completely shaded out gardens, though, and that's not always feasible. There are some other tips for microclimate to follow. Don't plant cold-sensitive plants, or really any plants, but especially cold-sensitive plants, in low areas because hot air rises and cold air falls, so creating that depression where the cold air can kind of gather and wind can whip through will increase the chance of cold injury to that particular plant. And then the third and really final recommendation for that is mulching. Mulch, mulch, mulch. There are so many benefits to mulching plants and garden beds. It keeps soil warmer in the winter. It keeps soil cooler in the summer, increases moisture retention, prevents injury from lawnmowers or weed eaters, serves an aesthetic purpose, keeps weeds at bay. There's a lot of benefits to mulching. So between orienting plants against walls, not planting in depressions, and maybe even planting in mounds if possible, and mulching, that's a good way to create a favorable microclimate that otherwise sensitive plants might be able to survive in. Your second option for being able to keep plants outside of their natural range is to grow in containers and then bring them inside during particularly cold spells. I see this a lot with citrus trees, particularly oranges and kumquats. Kumquats are a fun citrus tree to try and keep because they are the most cold hardy of the citrus trees. They are hardy down to 15 degrees, which is kind of rare for a citrus tree. But again, we are in zone 6B, which the average minimum temperature is -5 to 0. So it will take some vigilance on your part to check the weather and make sure that you're not going to accidentally leave it outside during during a freeze. But being able to move them in and out as you see fit. This is primarily going to be for specimen plants. You're not going to do this with the vast majority of your garden plants, unless you're super dedicated and have a lot of space indoors for garden plants. But being able to move them in and out gives you a lot of flexibility in what you can grow. And the third and final thing to do, if you do want to grow a out of range garden plant but don't want to lug containers in and out and in and out as the temperatures heat up and cool down, is protective coverings. And this can be as simple as a tarp draped over a tarp or blanket draped over your plant. You do want to make sure, if you do that, that the tarp or blanket is not touching the plant, because that tarp attracts moisture, and if it attracts moisture to the leaves, it can still cause freeze or frost injury on your sensitive plant. Other options include row covers, like plastic thrown over a PVC pipe frame. There's a lot of good DIY that you can do with protective coverings, and it will increase the flexibility of your garden on what you can grow. But that's kind of a primer on hardiness zones. If you want the 30-second summary, go down the middle when trying to pick plants that are hardy for our area. You don't want one that's, you know, too northern oriented that will suffer in our heat. You also don't want one that's too southern oriented where it might not survive the winter. Definitely do that research before buying a plant, because you don't want to be stuck with a plant that can't grow in our area. Kind of look into the different areas that you're going to be planting to see if you can provide a little more protection for your plants as winter draws near.
All right, so some great information on hardiness zones, and if anybody has any more, questions about this, Jesse, how can they get a hold of you?
Gerard office 620-724-8233 or email jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, Jesse and Holly. Thank you so much for coming in today. We hope to see you again in the future.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we'll start open lines. So keep it locked here on the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning in southeast Kansas.
Need a better vehicle, but you have bad credit? Roman Chevrolet Buick can.